The following Bible study was given many years ago by Art Bradick. Some of the specifics about the Ptolemy and Seleucid dynasties given in this study may not be entirely accurate. Further understanding of some historical details about the King of the South and the King of the North has been realized since the time that this study was recorded. Nonetheless, this understanding does not affect the conclusive interpretation of prophecies given in the following chapter of the Book of Daniel.
Last time we went through chapter 10, where an angel appeared to Daniel, and there he saw a vision, and the vision just overwhelmed him, really. And we saw in that case that there were demonic forces that influence leaders around the world, and that he uses, God does, uses magnificent spirit beings, angels, that fight in wars with these evil spirits to ensure that God's word is accomplished, that prophecy works out the way God said. And I think it's a fascinating insight to realize that rather than predicting the future, that God says he makes it come to pass. I will do all my pleasure. And he makes these things work out the way he said they would. So Daniel's deeply shaken, and then the angel restores him, and then he reveals to him the events that we find in chapter 11. And he gives Daniel the longest prophecy in the Bible. He gives him the most detailed prophecy in the whole Bible, covering about 2,500 years in advance easily, and it does so in pinpoint detail. For this reason, critics of the Bible say that Daniel was written after the fact, after all these events happened, because it's just too accurate, they say. But as we read, I want you to notice something that is, I believe, a proof that this could never be, and that is this. The revelation of this angel speaks with a certain attitude, you might say, that he tells the story with no malice, no rancor, no hostility. He just has a flat effect. The angel tells of these events as though they simply are what are going to happen from a standpoint of one who has the faith that he knows how the end is going to come out. And I want you to think about this. What if it was written after the fact? Well, it would have been written by a people who had suffered terribly under the Seleucid Empire, suffered terribly under the Ptolemies. And so they would have rancor, wouldn't they? The angel, or whoever was the author of this thing, if it was written after the fact, would have hostilities and deep-seated resentments toward the individuals they were talking about. You don't see any of this. And so that's another strong evidence, I believe, that this had to have been written before these events ever took place. So in chapter 11, there are events here given without symbol, as in other cases. They're not a vision in that sense, not symbolic. They're given in unvarnished historical fact, is the way I would say it. No names are mentioned, but the people in these cases are absolutely obvious, easily recognizable. And what you see is this. Great leaders come on the scene, they appear for a moment, and then they're gone. They take their bow, they take their spotlight in history, and then they have power, they have wealth, and they have success. And during this time, they may have seemed impressive to men, but it's much like, you might say, a child's sparkler on the 4th of July. It burns very brightly, but fizzles out very soon, and it goes dead, leaving nothing or little behind. And so God allows these powerful kingdoms to come on the stage of world history and on the scene. And they have their glory and their greatness. But the final act, what we'll see, belongs to God. The angel begins his work, we'll go to Daniel 11, by ensuring that Darius came to power. And verse 1 starts off this way. Also, I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And so this was in the third year of Cyrus that this occurred. And so this conflict that the angel had probably been 4 or 5 years old. And the reason for the conflict was this. It was the restoration of Judah. God had said that they would return to their land after 70 years. And the restoration of the temple was necessary to fulfill prophecy. The restoration of a people who were keeping God's law was absolutely necessary for the Messiah to be born. And remember Genesis 49, it said that he would be born of Judah, one. But also remember that there would have to be a people that existed who kept the law. Christ couldn't have been born in some Gentile community that was keeping Christmas and Halloween and all the things like we do today, because he would have had no place to live and grow and do his work. And so God brought these people back and established them so that there could be a place for the Messiah to be born. And so what would happen then would be this. There would have been a conflict because Satan would not want these people returning. He wouldn't want the foundation to be laid in which Christ could come. And so you'll see this, that we're going to read this through, and you're going to see that was that conflict, but we're going to see two others that would occur. One, of course, was in the case of Esther, and Haman tried to destroy the Jews. Another time, a little later on, we see the case of Antiochus Epiphanes, where there is a movement to just destroy these people. And anyone who would obey God, they were at risk of death. And so this is what we're seeing here work out in Daniel 11. And so we would see then angelic forces warring against demonic forces to ensure that God's word would occur exactly as he said. And so I remind us of this, that perhaps angelic beings were involved in the case of Esther and turning that situation around. That angelic beings perhaps must have been, if you think about, how could the Maccabees overcome Antiochus' army? How could any of this happen unless there were angelic, miraculous things happening? And I say this for a reason to us, too, today, and that is this, that God promises that nothing that hasn't happened to others happens to us, and that he'll provide a way of escape. And so there are angelic beings that fight for us in our life, and we can feel confident as we go through life, just as this angel was confident, knowing the end of all things as he spoke to Daniel. You could say the same thing about your life or my life. And so he begins then, the angel does, to reveal a prophecy that is going to extend from that time right until the return of Jesus Christ. And he begins here in verse 2. And he says, "Now will I show you the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia." Now actually it says there were four kings, but there were actually 12. But what is the angel is speaking of here is the four that mattered, the four that were important. And there was Cambyses in 529. He was Cyrus's elder son, and he's noted for being the first to conquer Egypt. There was Pseudo-Smyrnus, 523, and he's called Pseudo because Smyrnus actually was murdered by him, and he chose his name, and so they called him Pseudo-Smyrnus. There was Darius in 522. He was a Persian who was cousin to Cyrus and assassinated Pseudo-Smyrnus, and he took the throne. Now, it was interesting, the difference in these individual kings. I mentioned three here. The Persians called Cyrus the parent. He was a good and kind man. They called Cambyses the despot, and they called Darius the hoarder, or the merchant. Darius grew incredibly wealthy. He plundered temples and tombs. He took 500 talents of gold and silver and 300 pieces of silver from Thebes alone, just in one case. And the first thing he did when he took the territory over was he divided it into provinces so that he could use this as a means to tax the people. And he took tribute of, I think it was like 14,500 talents annually from the provinces, and would require other valuables and gold and so on from India and Arabia. So what happened, of course, is that this guy dies, and it's inherited by the fourth king, Xerxes, in 485. And so Xerxes inherits all this wealth that was hoarded by Darius. And he uses this wealth. He amasses this wealth, and he begins to use it over a four-year period to build an army for the very purpose of attacking Greece. And after the 4 years, it's recorded that he had an army that was 2,641,610 men. And they estimate with the servants and eunuchs and all the rest that would attend to this army that it could have been well up in the range of 5 million people. And that's a lot of people, and some people are shocked when they hear that the Exodus was at least 2 million. But think of 5 million men and supporting that kind of an army of people. Anyway, Xerxes finally experienced a crushing defeat. He first took Athens and reduced this thing to ashes. And then the Greek navy was able to rout him, and he fled into Asia. And then eventually all his land forces were destroyed as well. There's a lesson in this that I want to bring out, though, if you'll go over to Ecclesiastes 6. Sometimes people will spend an entire lifetime seeking wealth, trying to just acquire more and more wealth. They want to become rich in their time. But what happens? Have you ever noticed this? What happens? They leave their wealth to others, don't they? And others often waste it. And so it says in Ecclesiastes 6. And verse 1 and 2, there's an evil, he says, the preacher says, which I've seen under the sun, and it's common among men. A man to whom God has given riches, wealth, and honor, so that he wants nothing for his soul, all that he desires. But God gives him not power to eat of it, but a stranger eats of it. And this, he says, is vanity, and it's an evil disease. But you understand the point. You spend your whole life just acquiring wealth. And I've read cases, of course, where people would have millions of dollars under their bed and they'd live in poverty. But you understand, this man who hoarded and just made life miserable for everybody because he took their money and all the territories, built up an incredible amount of wealth. Xerxes squanders it on a war in which he loses everything. So I think we should always keep this vital lesson in mind. All the money belongs to God. And we are his stewards of that money. And it's fine to use it for our pleasures and to use it for things that are good. But to try to simply spend our lives striving to be rich, like some do in our world today, in the corporate world, is vanity in the end. They're just going to amass massive amounts of money that they'll ultimately leave to someone else. And in many cases, it's just wasted. But anyway, this brings us very close to the end of the time of the Persian Empire. But the Persian Empire left its mark on our civilization. They introduced what's called cultural pluralism. That is, the armies before them, like the Assyrians, even the Babylonians, why, they would take you captive, and then you had to worship their gods. You had to live their culture, became your culture. Why, the Persians were different. They let you keep your culture. They let you keep your gods, and that's why they were willing to let the Jews go back to their homeland and rebuild. And so the Jews were able to keep their culture. They were able to keep their religion. They were able to keep the knowledge of God alive. And it allowed the Jews to return to their homeland, to rebuild the temple and worship the true God, and provide a place for the Messiah to be born. But also it did something else. They built an incredible mail system that was the first of its kind that spread throughout the entire empire. And this mail system was later adapted by the Greeks and finally the Romans and improved upon. And it would be the mail system that would be there when the church was started, so that Paul could write these letters and they could be sent out to the various churches. And they contributed that to civilization. And then also during the Persian period, why, they have what they call the diaspora. That is, not everyone went back to Jerusalem, but they went out throughout the entire empire. And there they then built synagogues, so that when the church started, there would be synagogues for the people to go to, where Paul could go and he could preach in Ephesus. He could go to different places, and there would be a synagogue for him to preach in. And so this was the end of Daniel's vision for the chest of silver. Persia would give way to another empire, and it would give rise to the belly and thighs of brass. That is the Greek Empire. In verse 3 and 4, it says this, "And a mighty king shall stand up, and they shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided towards the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those." And so these verses refer to Alexander the Great. Verse 3 doesn't tell us, does it, that an empire changed. But verse 4 makes it very clear. Alexander's empire was split four ways. Remember when we went over Daniel 8 and we saw there this case of a he-goat, and it had two horns, and it represented the Medo-Persian Empire, and then came along another beast there. And remember, the leopard had four heads, and it represented the four divisions that his empire would be split into. This is reflecting this same kind of thing here. Philip of Macedonia had planned to defeat Persia after Xerxes had attacked, destroyed Athens, and so on. And he died before his plans were complete. So Alexander, his son, took those plans, and he completed the plan by invading them. Alexander the Great wrote this to the Persian king, and he said this: "Your ancestors entered into Macedonia and the other parts of Greece, and they did us damage when they had received no affront from us as the cause of it. And now I, created general of the Grecians, provoked by you and desirous of avenging the injury done by the Persians, have passed over into Asia." And so there's a great lesson from all of this. You understand that it's human nature at work. And I guess the lesson for us would be this: be careful about hurting others in our quest for success. The understanding in the corporate world, they will climb over people to try to get the promotion, to try to get the position, to try to get the raise. When you do this, you're going to infuriate people, aren't you? And you're opening yourself up. And that's what happened here. Xerxes had no idea what he was laying open for the rest of the world when he did this, because Alexander came back. As he said, he was provoked by you, and he came against those people in a devastation that was unparalleled. So anyway, realize this: in our rush to succeed, we've got to be careful we don't hurt others. You can't always not hurt people. Like I say, even in the Church of God or in marriage, you can't dance without stepping on someone's toes once in a while. So, you know, it's worthwhile to love, even if you're going to be hurt. It's worthwhile to have relationships. But, you know, we will sometimes be hurt in life, but try not to hurt other people. The other thing is this: the exact example to me of Alexander is this world's maxim: get them before they get you. Or to do unto others, only do it first. Right? That kind of thing. The point is, don't follow this. Look at his example and be abhorred by it. That revenge isn't ours, is it? So Paul says in Romans, he says, "Recompense no man for evil. Provide things honest instead in the sight of all men." So this is the big problem with human nature. It's the defense mechanism, that if someone hurts you, you want to hurt them back. So your mate says something cutting to you, you want to cut them back. Somebody does something at work to you, you want to do something back to them. And everybody that goes to war, I think, does so because they are defending themselves. And so the Japanese had to do this. You see, we cut off their oil. The Germans had to attack. They needed living space. You see, it's never us being bad. It's always us reacting to the other person. But when we do, what happens? We become evil just like them. And that's what we want to try to avoid as Christians. So Alexander stood up, and he had great dominion, and he did as he willed. He was an amazing military commander, just amazing. He met and conquered the Persian army at Issus in 333, and then he turned and attacked Egypt. And his army went as far as Afghanistan and India today. He went north and took Babylon in 327. And he moved so fast, it was as if his feet didn't touch the ground, as you remember from another prophecy, that he was the first to use this principle of blitzkrieg in battle. He just used overwhelming force, and he did it with lightning speed. So by 327, he had conquered almost all of Western civilization. The known world was his. And he consolidated his empire after this, but not for long. From 327 to 323, he consolidated the empire. But in boredom, after he had conquered the known world, he died from just dissipating himself. He died in a fever in 323, after a drunken debauch. Now, some say that he was poisoned, and that's possible. But historians say that his last days were filled with depression. You know why? He was drinking continuously. His last words were, there's no more worlds to conquer. He had done what he wanted to do. He'd accomplished his task. Now, there's a great contrast between Alexander the Great and Jesus Christ. Alexander spent all of his adult life trying to take from others, other nations. Jesus Christ spent his whole life doing what? Trying to give to other people. Alexander died at 33 years of age. Jesus Christ died at 33 years of age. Alexander the Great died the richest man in the world. Jesus Christ died the poorest. He had his garment, and that's all, and then they cast lots for that. It's said when Alexander died, I read this in a book once, that they carried his coffin in the procession and that they drilled holes in the side of the coffin and they put his hands out so that everyone in the whole procession could see. He died with empty hands. He had nothing. The man thought to have everything died with nothing. The man Jesus Christ, who was thought to have nothing, inherited all things because of the way he lived. There's a tremendous example for us. The prophecy says that he would be broken when he was strong and says that the kingdom wouldn't go to his posterity. And so it was that he left no inheritor for the throne. So upon his death, the empire was left leadership-less and in great confusion. So Pittacus ruled until 321, and then he was murdered. Antigonus was killed in the Battle of Ipsus in 301. After this, then, the four divisions that were prophesied came to emerge in about 301, and those four generals became the Diadochi, the successors. And they split the territory among themselves. Ptolemy, Soter, ruled Egypt, part of Syria, and Judah. Seleucus Nicator ruled Syria, Babylon, and parts east from there. Lysicomus ruled Asia Minor, and Cassandra ruled Greece and Macedonia. Those were the four. And so what the rest of this book will do is focus on two of these groups, that is, the Seleucids and Ptolemies, the king of the north and the king of the south. Anyway, I want to add this, that as Persia added its part to the Western civilization and to the world that would come, so did the Greeks. Alexander Hellenized much of the empire. He encouraged a lot of intermarriage, and he spread Hellenistic thinking throughout the rest of the empire. And so the thing about the Greeks is they had a love of learning, and they brought the Greek language, and they spread the Greek language through the entire parts of Western civilization. And that meant there'd be a living language there, the language that the Bible would be written in, the New Testament. And so that language would exist as a living language so that people would be able to read the letters, read the Bible as the Bible spread throughout the time. And they also, they had a value for man, and they had a philosophy. They cared greatly for philosophy. I remember my English teacher told me this, that the Greeks had actually figured out that man was born to become God, that God was a family. They could look at the creation and they made this conclusion. But they were great philosophers. But what they did is they provided a love of learning. They provided what never existed before, and that was the value of mankind. Before, mankind were only cannon fodder. But because of their philosophy, men had a value, and they spread this throughout the empire. So again, when the Bible came teaching that a man was the most valuable thing, you see, there was a place for it. Well, there never would have been in the Assyrian Empire. They were just brutal and barbaric. So you see the value of this as they spread this throughout the land, an educational system that we actually use today even. Language and thought provided for the foundation of the New Testament. Now the prophecy focuses on two of these four empires, as I said, the king of the north and the king of the south. The king of the south would be Ptolemy, and the king of the north, Seleucus. And the Holy Land was now going to repeatedly change hands back and forth like a ping pong ball between these two empires. And so verse 5 then begins to look at the king of the south. And the king of the south, it says, shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion, and his dominion shall be a great dominion. And so it was that Ptolemy had ambitions that were far greater than just the ruling of Egypt alone. He intended to take pieces of Cyprus and, Eventually, he grew to have influence in parts of the mainland, the Greek mainland. Anyway, he became a very powerful ruler. He was called Soter, and he developed Egypt far beyond what even Alexander the Great had done. And he eventually, of course, had and originally had control over the Holy Land and God's people for a time. And there was a prince that was stronger above him, and this was Seleucus Nicator. And he first served under Petticus and then Antigonus. But he had a falling out with Antigonus, and he defected to Ptolemy. We begin to see the intrigues here. So now he's the buddy of Ptolemy down here in Egypt. But after the death of Antigonus, he goes back up to the area of Babylon. There he becomes king of the old territory in about 310 BC. And his domain then far surpassed that of the king of the south. And it went from Phoenicia and Syria on the west all the way to India. And his power was so much greater than the king of the south for many, many years. And so it says in verse 6, in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. So, about 4 or 5 decades later, that this was fulfilled to the letter. The king of the north was Antiochus II now, and he was called Theos. His surname was Theos. Antiochus II was married to a powerful woman named Laodice, and she influenced Antiochus to go to war with the Ptolemy too, and his name was Philadelphus. And this conflict went on for about 35 years, and finally there was a treaty made between the two of them, king of the north and king of the south. So in about 252, this treaty of peace was agreed upon. Now here were the terms of the treaty, that Ptolemy's daughter would now marry the Seleucid king. And it was complicated, though, because the king of the north was already married to Laodice. Okay, now Antiochus divorces Laodice then and banishes her from the court. But from her banishment, she organizes a resistance movement, and her assistants were able to kill the daughter of the king of the south and her infant son. Now, what happens now is the Seleucid king brings her back and as his wife again, but she didn't trust him after what went on, so she poisons him. And now the ones that were pro-Laodice, they organized a coup. They take over the kingdom, and she rules as a queen there until what happens later is the son of the king of the south now comes up and takes over later. He comes up and takes and kills her eventually. Now, it says this. It says, when he that begat her, and this should more likely be the child from who she brought forth. It's a poor translation, but it looks a little bit backwards. It says, he that begat her, and it really means that this woman, Bernice was her name, her child died. If you read it the other way, it seems like Ptolemy, the king of the south, died. He that begat her. And so it's a bit of a mistranslation there. And so the prophecy was fulfilled perfectly. Antiochus II came to his end. The daughter of Philadelphus came to her end with all her nobles and supporters. And after this, Philadelphus' child, the son, finally came and destroyed her. Now I want to ask this, and forgive me for this if you think I'm speculating too far, but could there be a parallel here? I don't know if you picked up on some of the names here. The names of Philadelphus, Laodice. All you need to do is put an A on there, and you have Laodicea. See? It seems significant to me. Could there be some foreshadowing here, but regarding the conflict about the two churches at the end of the age, Philadelphia and Laodicea? To me, it seemed like, as I read this, and I studied it in detail, and I really prayed over this a lot, to see if I was just stretching this, or was it coincidence, or was there something here. But you know, there is often duality in the scriptures. And it looked to me like there could be, and I want to suggest it's possible, there could be some symbolism here that reflects our understanding of the end time. Think about it this way. The king of the north is a type of the beast. The beast sits in the temple in the end time, remember, showing that he is God. And so what was the name of this king of the north? Theos. So he's calling himself actually God. Okay, now he's married to Laodice. And Laodice could well represent this whore that has the same spirit, that is lukewarm towards the things of God, willing to compromise, willing to bring in pagan traditions, pagan ideas. That's the spirit that Laodicea has. And so could it be then that you have a beast called Theos then married to this Laodice that would represent this whore at the end? And then think about the daughter of Philadelphus. Who comes out of Philadelphia? Philadelphia is the sixth era of the church, and then Laodicea comes out of her, and they coexist at the same time. Now, what does Laodicea do? Laodicea goes through the tribulation period, and the tribulation makes some in Laodicea go one way or the other, don't they? Some are going to be martyrs and be in the kingdom, but what do others do? Well, I'll suggest to you they marry the beast power is what they do. Look, it says this, some at the end forsake the holy covenant, doesn't it, in Daniel 11:30. We're told that in Matthew 24 that brethren at the end during the tribulation would betray other brethren. And we see in Revelation 12 an army goes after those that are taken to a place of safety. How can an army go after the church if they weren't reported on by those that were part of them, you see? And so at the end then, this beast has the power to scatter God's holy people. And at the end, all support who support this whore are also destroyed. So my point is this. It's possible. I may be reading more into this, but boy, when I look at the names, Theos and Philadelphus and Laodice, man, it's just too close to me. So I may be stretching it here. I'll admit that, but there may be more here that we just haven't seen yet, and maybe I'm just getting some impressions at this time too. So for whatever it's worth here. So next there's retaliation then from the king of the south. Remember I said his son is going to now retaliate. Daniel 11 and verse 7 this time. But out of a branch of her roots, that is, out of her roots, which would be her father, Ptolemy, the king of the south, shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail. So the branch out of her roots was her brother, Ptolemy, and his name is Euergetes, I think it is. Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, died in 247. He was unable to respond to this terrible tragedy that happened in his old age. His son, Ptolemy III, organized a force to avenge his sister. And the son of Philadelphus then retaliated, coming with an army. He went into their capital, actually slew Laodice, and then during a four-year siege, his son pillaged Antioch, the northern capital, and invaded the eastern domains and really wreaked havoc on the navy as well. And then he returns to Egypt loaded with spoil. Read this in verse 8 and verse 9. And so he also carried captives into Egypt their gods, with their princes, and with their precious vessels of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. So now this Egyptian king comes into the land of the king of the north. He carries away like 40,000 talents of silver and gold and took many precious vessels. But what was interesting is he took over 2,400 images and idols that were originally taken captive by Kamses. So again, the king of the north comes down. This is what we're going to keep saying. King of the north comes here. These guys wreak havoc on these guys wreak havoc on these guys. And who's in the middle? God's people. God's people are in the middle. So anyway, he goes down and he now takes all these Egyptian gods and he brings them back to his own land, to Egypt. Now, the people in Egypt were so grateful that they named him the name that he had, and it was Euergetes. You know what it means? Benefactor. That's what it means. Perhaps this is what Christ alluded to when he said that those that lord it over others, that is like the king told me, are called what? Benefactors. But it shall not be so among you, that we're instead to be servants of one another and servants of God. But perhaps this is what he was referring to when he used that particular term. And it seems to have been reflected down through history to some degree. So anyway, it says he'll continue more years than the king of the north. And it could have two meanings, and that is that he would outlive the king of the north for, and he did, for 4 years. But there's another translation where it says that he would leave the king alone for a number of years. And so Ptolemy concentrated on the Aegean conquest for some number of years and just left the northern king alone for a long time. And after this, then, you're going to see conflicts and wars back and forth. King of the north, king of the south, and the power is going to shift from one back to the other and back again. And so in the middle of this, you know what's going to happen. God's people, the Jewish people, are going to make wrong choices, and so they're going to become the captive of these guys, then they're going to become the captive of those guys. And so next, the king of the north now retaliates, and he attacks Egypt. Daniel 11 and verse 10. But his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then he shall return and be stirred up even to his fortress. And so his sons would be stirred up. That is, it means that they would become angry. And of course, they'd be angry at who? They'd be angry at the king of the south. So Seleucid II dies in 226 and is succeeded by his son, Seleucid III. He rules for like 3 years and dies from a fallen horse. Another son, Cyrenus, continues after him, but he dies very soon and is succeeded by his brother Antiochus III. And then this Egyptian war continues on by this single son, and that's why it talks about a single one. It was Antiochus III, and he was surnamed Antiochus the Great. And he assembled massive forces, and he attacked the king of the south. When it says he overflowed, it just means he was just very successful, like a wave. You can't stop the wave, can you, when it comes in? You can hold your hands up, put your fins up if you want, but you can't stop the wave. It just overwhelms you. And so he took over the land of Palestine again. And he experienced, however, a defeat in all of this that slowed him up a little bit. And the king of the south makes a brief comeback in Daniel 11, verse 11 and 12. And so the king of the south shall be moved with choler at his anger and come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. And when he's taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many, 10,000s, that is myriad, it really just means myriads, but he shall not be strengthened by it. And so the king of the south marches in a battle of rage to the north, and the northern army had a great army, but it was defeated. So anyway, Antiochus III now succeeds Phoenicia and Palestine back to Ptolemy, and the Holy Land is again bouncing back and forth. And he would only hold these possessions temporarily. It says that he wasn't strengthened by the success. And there was a reason for this, why he wasn't strengthened. He made a treaty with Antiochus, and then he arrogantly returned back to Egypt, and he enjoyed basically lavishing himself in dissipation and spoiling and pampering himself, if you will. But I say this now in terms of a lesson for us. There is a principle here. You understand, he attained success, and then he let down. He went back. He was satisfied with it. He went back rather than pushing on and just made a treaty quickly, goes back, and then he just spends his time on himself. And many times there is a principle in life that I've seen that I want to bring out here, and this is an example of it, I think. We will sacrifice and do what's necessary to attain success in life. We'll work, we'll struggle, we'll sacrifice, we'll give up things for a goal we have and for an end that we have. And then, once we reach the goal, we tend to let down. Well, I remember a man who worked so hard to start a business, and he had that business running in the third year. It finally got off the ground. The fourth year, it's improving. Fifth year, it's getting better. You know, sixth year, he's a success. The seventh year, he lost it. because once it was going and big and successful, he stopped doing the things that made it successful. Don't you see a pattern in America today that we sacrifice and we had principles that we believed in and we sacrificed for and it built a country that was great and powerful, and yet the new generation comes and they've forgotten what it was that made them strong and successful. And so they let down. And you can let down and then the success slips away and ends in defeat. So it was that Alexander, after he conquered all those empires, he let down and went into dissipation. Christopher Columbus died in depression because he had attained the goal and he didn't know what to do next. And you know what happens? Many Christians in their life will attain a certain amount of success. You start out and you're overwhelmed. Wow, the truth and the pieces start to fit together. And you're so excited and you study and you pray and everything. And then after a while you think, well, I pretty much know the doctrines. I pretty much have this under my belt. I understand. I don't need to study this much. And I'm not sinning all that. Most of my, I don't keep Christmas. I'm not murdering. I'm not lying. I'm not sinning much and so on. And so you tend to do what? You think you stand. And what does the Bible say? Boy, as soon as you do that, you're ready for a fall. So that's the tendency. Paul, I think, had the greatest approach. He said what? I don't count myself to have apprehended, even though he'd look all he had done. And he says, I don't count myself to have apprehended, this one thing I do. Forgetting those things that are behind, I'm still pressing forward. I'm still going forward, pressing for the prize of that high calling. So that's the attitude we should have. But you understand my point. The example of these men in history is one that we should learn lessons from vicariously so we don't have to learn them in our lives. Okay. So the king of the south let down after his successes, and so now the king of the north is going to return again. Okay, Daniel 11, verse 13. So then the king of the north shall return and set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and much riches. So 14 years later, Ptolemy IV had died, I think it was, and he was succeeded by Ptolemy V now, but he was only 4 years old at this time. So Antiochus now sees his chance to return. So next year he raises an army that's even greater and finances. It's rich, it says in the Bible. That is, he finances this thing. It's really well equipped. And he advances against Phoenicia and Palestine once again in verse 14. And in those times, many shall stand up against the king of the south. Also, it says, the robbers of the people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. Now, it was a case where others besides the king of the north opposed him. Philip of Greece agreed to attack him. He helped take part of Phoenicia, part of Syria from him. And then additionally, within their own ranks, there was a treasonous plot in Egypt that took place. A guy named Scopas, an Aetolian, attempted rebellion against the king, but the prime minister of Egypt thwarted it. But still, this was another factor that weakened the king of the south's empire. Now, it says the robbers of thy people. It's a poor translation, I believe. The word robbers is P-E-R-I-T-Y-S in the Hebrew. But it means violent ones or tyrants. And there were tyrannical leaders that existed in the Holy Land at this time. They were part of the Southern Party, the Ptolemy Party. And they changed sides. They went over to the side of Antiochus and wanted to cut a deal. Josephus writes of them this. Of their own accord went they over to him and received him into the city, Jerusalem, and gave plentiful provisions to his army and to his elephants, and readily assisted him when he besieged the garrison, which was in the citadel of Jerusalem. So these guys were, in a sense, robbers, you understand, taking what wasn't theirs and giving it to this other individual. But they were also leaders among the people that thought they would set themselves up, you see, with a new leader. Now, we'll just ally ourselves with the new guy here. But it says this, they exalted themselves in order to establish the vision, is one way that you can read this. And so it's believed by some that what they were trying to do is they read the prophecy, they went about trying to establish the prophecy. And we'll just be a part of this prophecy, you see. We'll make it happen. And what I'm saying is this: be careful when you think this way. It's presumption when you think that you're going to fulfill the prophecy. Remember, Moses thought he was the one, didn't he? So he kills the Egyptian, and what did he do? He paid dearly. He had to go out and lead sheep for 40 years after that one. The people in Christ's day, they saw him working miracles, didn't they? And they knew that it was time for the Messiah to come. And so what did they do? They tried to forcibly make him king, and he had to slip away and get away from them so that he didn't start some sort of riot or something. And some even believe this, that it was a case of Judas was not trying to just get money and turn Christ in. It wasn't that he was angry with Jesus and I'm going to do away with him. But some believe that what he wanted to do was he just wanted to put Jesus in a position where he would be forced to defend himself against Rome, and therefore it would force his hand and make him become the Messiah he was supposed to be, you see, or that they thought he was supposed to be. But you understand, they were people, this is a spirit of people that are trying to establish the prophecy themselves. Well, what do we see today? Even in the churches of God, people claiming to be Elisha, people claiming that they're the one and only true church, and you have to be in their church in order to you know, be on God's payroll, as it were, be in the kingdom or something. You understand what I'm saying? Isn't this it? Someone calling themselves God's witness? Don't do this. Don't take it upon yourself to say, I'm going to fulfill this prophecy. That's what I put this in the context of. It's so dangerous, and it's so presumptuous. What we want to do is humbly serve God in any way he wants. And just like it was with Jacob, what did he do? Force the prophecy, steal the birthright. And so he pays this terrible price of having to run away and work for nothingness for a long time. So you understand, we can trust God. He'll work the prophecy out, won't he? We don't have to force it. We don't have to feign dangle. He'll take care of things, and we can trust him in all of this. Now, it says that these tyrants will fall, these robbers, these tyrants would fall, and their objective was to fulfill the scriptures on this. But think what was motivating them. Self-aggrandizement. They wanted to be a part of the winning party, to be in with the new management, as it were. So the thing I say is this, though. When Antiochus returned, even though they helped him from Egypt, he stopped again in Jerusalem, and he slew many of the party of Ptolemy who had even helped him earlier before. And the lesson here, I think, is really a valuable lesson. Be careful who we ally ourselves with. You may get bit. There was a rabbit once, did you hear this one, who wanted to cross a river. And he couldn't think of any way to get across the river. And a snake, a water snake, water python, came by and saw the rabbit and said, you want to cross the river? And he says, yes, I do. And he says, well, why don't you hop on my back and I'll take you across the river? And the rabbit says, oh, no, you don't. I know you. You're a snake. Why, you'll get me halfway across that river and I won't be able to run away from you, and you'll turn and eat me. And the snake said, oh, no, absolutely. I give you my word. I promise you I won't do this. And the rabbit goes, okay. And he gets on the snake's back, and the snake gets out in the middle of the river, and he turns and says, I have to do this. And he eats the rabbit. And as the rabbit's about to be eaten, he says, but you promised. You said you wouldn't do this. And the snake says to him, I'm a snake. I have to do this. This is what I do. But you understand why I'm saying this, that we shouldn't trust snakes. And I've seen the people of God do this. They are innocent, trusting, but someone will come along and say, man, have I got a deal for you, you know? And they'll ally themselves with someone that's trying to make money quick or something, and they'll just get burned. I've seen people lose their homes because they've allied themselves with somebody. So the issue is this, is we don't want to do this. Let's go to 1 Corinthians, if you will, 15, so I don't, I'll just kind of skip one so I can save some time here. But you understand my point is this, as it says in 1 Corinthians 5, don't associate with someone who's a fornicator, covetous, idolater, a railer. Don't associate with these, a drunkard, an extortioner. With them, don't eat. Don't associate yourself with them. In another place, it says that we're not to be yoked with unbelievers. Well, why? What's the point of this? And he says this in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33. Don't be deceived. Evil communications corrupt good manners. That is, when you're in a relationship with people who aren't striving to be good, it can corrupt your character. It can change you. It can hurt you. And it could be that you ultimately get bit. You get hurt. And so I think there's a lesson here. These people that thought, well, we'll just ally ourselves with the king of the north. What happened? He turned on them, just like the snake. And so we've got to be careful as we maneuver ourselves through life and circumstances and situations that we don't really trust in those that are just out to try to make money. If someone's going to try to make a fast buck off of somebody else, do you really want to do that? Do you really want to do that? Or do you want to produce and provide and give something back for the money that you receive? Isn't that the way God would want us to do it? So anyway, it happened to those that allied themselves with Antiochus. Daniel 11, 15 and 16. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that comes against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. And so Antiochus the Great came against these provinces again in 198 B.C., took over Sidon and destroyed the Egyptian interest in Judea, took over the whole land. And it says that he cast up a mount, that is, he set up a fortress, a fortification. He was so entrenched that he couldn't be dislodged, and so he took the fenced cities, fortified cities, until there was nothing left. Now, when it says the chosen people, you might read commentaries, and they'll suggest that it means God's people. But I don't think it really means that. I think it means Egyptians' best. Scopas was the Egyptian general. He was defeated there by the armies of Antiochus, and he fled, fortified himself. Antiochus followed him and laid siege to him. And then this Egyptian general called for help and reinforcements, and he called for specific ones. And so they sent three generals with the specific army, and I think those were the chosen ones that were sent. But they never got there in time, and because of famine, he had to surrender. And then those chosen forces retreated back to Egypt. So he stood in the glorious land, Antiochus did. As you can imagine, these massive movements of men and soldiers. It says that he consumed it. And man, this happens, doesn't it? Can you imagine a 2 million man, 3-4 million man army moving into the Holy Land area? What would it be like after they were there? I mean, in every case, it would just be consumed. Josephus writes this, "In the reign of Antiochus the Great, who ruled over all Asia, that the Jews suffered greatly, and their land was sorely harassed. For while he was at war with Ptolemy Philopater, that these nations were sufferers, both when he was beaten and when he beat the others, so that they were like a ship in a storm which is tossed by the waves on both sides. And just thus were they in this earth situation, right in the middle." Man, just raping the land. Now, you read about the land of prosperity, right? The land of milk and honey. You read of this promised land like it's this wonderful land. And I remember when I went there, it's been raped. Just raped. I mean, it almost, except for the Jordan Valley, the Sea of Galilee, and right along the Jordan, there's the Dead Sea, and it's just nothing can grow there. It's like moonscape all around. The Turks came down, they did their damn, they just took the trees, all the timber. It's just been just, every empire has passed through this place and just taken and taken and taken. There's just hardly anything left. You wonder, you go over and you say, what are you fighting over this for? You know, Pacoima would be better, you know? Okay. So, Antiochus the Great now forms a plan that he wants to take everything for himself. Verse 17. He also shall set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her. But she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. And that's all I want to read. So Antiochus resolved to overcome the Egyptians entirely and bring them all under his control. And he wants to do this, build a huge army, and continue south and just invade all of Egypt. And he planned then to use all of the forces that he had in his control. But he was interrupted in this because of wars with the Romans. And he felt that, look, he had done such a good job in destroying the Egyptian general that he could just take this all the way, like we perhaps should have done in Iraq. And we've talked about, you know, how Patton should have just kept continuing. And he was in a similar situation. He thought, well, he'll just do that. But what happened was he began to get more and more involved with wars with the Romans. And then he thought, oh no, what if the Egyptians side with the Romans? Then I'll have wars on two fronts and I won't be able to do this. So what he did was he devised a plan to bind the Egyptian king to him, and I believe also to plant a spy there. Now it says that he brought upright ones with him. And of course, if you read commentaries, they'll say these were righteous people. But I don't think they were righteous people. If you look at the actual word, it's yashar in the Hebrew, and it means properly, directly. It means upright or straight. But it also figuratively means convenient or pleasing. And one possible translation would be the trusted ones. Okay, the next word where it says ones, upright ones, the ones is unique in that it's ben in the Hebrew, and it means son or upholder of the family name. So Marty Ben Cobb means Marty, the son of Cobb, or it means Marty, the upholder of Cobb, or the family name. So, but you understand what I'm getting here is that it's more like these were trusted sub-leaders, in all likelihood family members, is what I'm thinking it was. Actual family members that went with him, and strong supporters. And I think the next verse corroborates this, because it says he's going to give the daughter of women here. And so there was family involved in this whole scheme, you see. And so it would have been likely that trusted family members would have been involved in the whole thing, in this maneuver of his. He was going to give his daughter to marry the Egyptian prince here. And at worst, this would give him neutrality from the Egyptians, he believed. At best, he would have an insider who always knew the mind of the king of the south. And so anyway, she could be a spy when he felt ready to invade. Now, her name was Cleopatra, and I'm not sure on this, but you know, the commentaries say that she was not the famous Cleopatra, that actually came later. All of this political maneuvering corrupted her, as you can see that now. As a part of her dowry, she was promising part of Syria and Palestine to the Ptolemies. But this, of course, was never delivered. As a result, Cleopatra, it says, did not stand with Antiochus, but she recognized she was just being used as a pawn in this whole political maneuver. So she then sided with her husband and supported his interests, which then became her interests. You see, I think she had really learned from Antiochus, look out for your own interest and not anybody else's. So after believing that he had neutralized Egypt, then he turns his attention elsewhere. Let's look at that in verse 18. After this shall he turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many. But a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. So he turns his attention now to the isles in the Mediterranean Sea there, part of his Roman wars. And he desired so greatly to expand his territory, he thought he could attack there. And he took many of the islands there, and he caused a reproach to fall on the Romans as a result of this. And his maritime wars lasted approximately 3 years until finally he was defeated. Now, he was defeated by an individual, a prince, who operated on his own behalf. That is, he did not wage war for justice, for country, for honor, but he waged war on others and took their lands for his own glory. And this individual was Lucius, A-S-I-A-T-I-C-U-S, is the way his name is spelled. Anyway, after defeating Hannibal, this particular general, the Roman general, defeated Hannibal, and then he asked for permission to fight against Antiochus. And Antiochus began to lose many battles. Finally, he fled, leaving his military stores behind, and tried to negotiate for peace. And the Romans said this, we'll let you surrender and we'll let you negotiate peace, but you have to give us all your possessions in Europe and Asia Minor, one. You have to surrender your entire navy to us, and all of your elephants. And so you'd have to also, he said, pay the cost of the war. And so Antiochus said, he thought this over, and he says, maybe I'll try and fight him again. So he brought about 70,000 infantrymen into battle and 12,000 cavalry, and there were camels and many, many elephants that he brought to bear. The Roman army that he fought, and this shows what kind of a general they had, the Romans were, remember, the legs of iron, I believe, and they were strong. They had 30,000 against 70,000. And in the 190 range, why the reproach offered by Antiochus against the Romans was turned on him. He was defeated in the Battle of Magnesia. The Roman army only lost 325 men. They lost, on the other side, 50,000 infantry, 4,000 cavalry, and 15 elephants all lay dead on the battleground. With only a loss of 325 to the Romans. Man, that's an amazing victory. So Antiochus is now forced to accept their terms, isn't he? And he has to give up the territory. He has to pay the expenses for the war. He was only allowed to have, I think, 12 ships and no elephants. Oh, tragedy, no elephants. Anyway, we live in a different world today, certainly. But to ensure his compliance with these terms, the Romans took 20 hostages, and of those hostages, they took one of his sons. The name of that son? Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes was a hostage taken to Rome, and there in Rome, he learned political intrigue, all about political intrigue. And by this then, Antiochus ceases trying to conquer other lands, and he returns to try and fortify his own land in verse 19. Then he shall turn his face towards the fort of his own land, it says, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So he eventually stumbled and fell. And what happened was he was trying to plunder a temple in Elamis, and he was likely trying to just get money to pay these Romans what he had to pay them. But these people were so incensed that he was trying to plunder their temple that they attacked. And they beat him, and they killed him there. So anyway, the vacuum then, by the loss of this leader, leads to another leader in this area, and that's in verse 20. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. So he's succeeded then by a raiser of taxes, and you can imagine why it would be a raiser of taxes. Still trying to pay this Roman debt that it was had to be paid off. So his son Seleucus IV reigns, sends a tax collector, Heliodorus, throughout the land. And it says that he would do this in the glory of the kingdom. It simply means that he would tax the more wealthy areas where they had money and the areas that had it. So he tried to raise money from this Roman debt and that he had, or some would suggest perhaps he had the hopes of future wars. But what happened was, this occurs in the Holy Land. There was a man named Simon who was a Benjamite who had spite towards the high priest. So what he did is he sent word of the gold of the temple that was in Jerusalem. And so they sent the tax collector there to collect all the gold in the temple. And this man had a dream then, it says in history, of angels flogging him. And so he refused to go down. And again, this is, I think, you can see angelic forces working behind the scenes, I think, in some of this. And so he did not take the gold of the temple at that time. So anyway, Seleucus IV, he reigned only for a few days, it says. That is, he lasted 11 years. And then he died not from anger, not from wars, but he was poisoned by his tax collector. That the tax collector thought that he could take over the throne and take the crown. But just before Seleucus died, he made a trade. That is, he traded his own son for his brother. His brother was Antiochus Epiphanes, one of the hostages. So now Antiochus Epiphanes is on his way down to come back and be a part of the kingdom there. And he becomes this new ruler of the king of the south. In our last verse here, in verse 21, and in his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. So Antiochus Epiphanes had learned political intrigue in Rome, and now he heard of the plot, and he returned and then was going to take the throne for himself. And he's going to use his political expertise, that is, flatteries, to do this. Next time, Antiochus Epiphanes.